Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with me, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking with Ryan Atkinson on Eruption on Expedition. So what we're going to do is really just dig into Ryan's expertise and indeed experience of filming directly in the middle of an active volcano. So deep in the heart of Africa lies the Nyiragongo volcano, one of the most spectacular volcanoes on Earth, and indeed one of the most dangerous. So with the largest continual active lava lake, the volcano has erupted twice in the past 50 years due to war and humanitarian crisis in the region. And indeed, the activity of the volcano itself, the Nyiragongo happens to be one of the least studied volcanoes in the world. So back in 2016, a film crew, including Ryan and a local team of scientists, immersed themselves in this actual volcano to study the Nyiragongo and discover the warning signs of a potential another eruption. So joining me is Ryan Atkinson. Ryan is an award-winning hostile environment trained cameraman focusing on documentaries, indeed in wildlife, science, climate, and indeed human interest. So Ryan comes from a diverse background of drama and commercials through to wildlife and also expedition filming. So he's worked as the DOP or director of photography across multiple genres of specialist factual filmmaking. Welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here again.
It's great to have you back on the podcast. Ryan, I just wonder if we could just start with just unpacking your role as a DOP or director of photography for listeners. Just maybe just speak into what the role entails and indeed some of the production companies you've worked for in the past.
Yeah, so a director of photography's they're kind of at the top of the tree in terms of the craft department. So the people that make it look good. Obviously I didn't start as a DOP, you know, this is 14 years in this career now, and worked my way up through assistant camera, camera operator, but the director of photography, they kind of sit at the top. So they are often in documentary stuff, they're self-shooting, so they are filming themselves as well, but then they'll be responsible for directing and guiding a team of camera people. That could be a mix of specialist camera people, it could be self-shooting producers, and they're kind of, I think they're the director of photography role transcends, it's not just the filming stage, you're often involved in the planning stages and the post-production stages as well, kind of setting the overall look and tone of the production. You can be involved in crew selection, extensively involved in deciding what equipment's most appropriate. On this shoot specifically, the one we're going to talk about in Nyiragongo, I wasn't actually director of photography on that. I was there as one of the lead cameramen, working under a very good friend of mine and actually my mentor, who I worked for as a camera assistant initially, Will Edwards. So he was running the show on that one. But yeah, I learned a lot from that guy.
Ryan, could you speak to the inception of the trip to East Africa and indeed sort of where the idea was born and how it came to be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it goes back to there was another expedition, which I can't remember exactly. I think it would have been around 2013, 2014, called Operation Gold Rush, run by BBC Science, where quite a large team of us effectively retraced the steps of the Yukon Gold Rush. So we, you know, started in Skagway, skied over the mountains in Alaska and rafted along the river. And it was a huge logistical expedition, and it was a really great three-part TV series. We had historian with us. We actually had a doctor, a HeliMed doctor, Kevin Fong, with us as well. So we're kind of looking at various aspects of the expedition. But off the back of that, you know, we gelled really well together as a team. We really enjoyed telling a story in that way. And there were lots of conversations during the expedition and afterwards about what else we might want to do. And then I think it would have been a couple of years later. Again, I'm a bit hazy on my dates back then, but it was probably around 2017. I got a call from a guy called Simon, who had been one of the producers on Operation Gold Rush, telling me that he was involved as a series producer on getting another expedition off the ground, which at the time the working title was Into the Volcano. And he basically kind of gave me the lowdown on what we wanted to do, and that he wanted to pull some of the team from Operation Gold Rush back together to work on this new project with BBC Science. So it was a massive undertaking. Planning started a good year or two before the expedition itself. We were mostly UK crew, but working with international scientists and stuff. There were a lot of meetings, a lot of traveling down to London for risk planning, kit prep, things like that. So it was a really long lead up period, and kind of necessitated just by the risks and the logistical challenges of such an expedition. We knew from the outset it was going to be a huge undertaking, and we didn't know if it would be successful. But we were a proven team, all excited to work together again and see what we could do.
Let's just dig into those risks, actually, Ryan, because, like you said, there is a number of moving parts to the expedition, and indeed some significant risks. Being in East Africa, in Congo, if I'm right in thinking, which in itself carries a number of risks. Could you maybe speak to some of the sort of main risk factors, and indeed how you sort of navigated those risks?
It was the Democratic Republic of Congo is where Nyiragongo is. It's inside Virunga National Park. In terms of risk, we've spoken before. I like to kind of, as a way of processing and getting my head around risk planning, I like to break it down into two categories, so environmental risk and human risk. And Democratic Republic of Congo, and specifically this eastern border region, throws up no end of risk in both of those categories. So we had a safety team that were on board from the early days, led by Aldo Kane, and he had a team working underneath him. And then we were working very closely with a consulting organization, who also do a lot of risk assessment and security advisory stuff for TV and film. But I guess the kind of the main environmental risks sort of speak for themselves. It's an active volcano, so it's high. There was an altitude factor there. It's just I think it's just under or just over 3,500 meters, and there's lava. Lava. I don't need to go into the risks that lava presents, but along with that, you've obviously got noxious gases, and then just the kind of environmental risks, the slips, trips, and falls. You're working on the side of a mountain, neither side of which do you really want to fall down. One way you end up going down rock slopes into the forest, and the other way you end up going into a crater. So bad things lie both directions. And then I guess from a medical perspective, you've got a big risk in that region of infectious diseases. There's quite an extensive history in that area of cholera, and obviously more recently Ebola outbreaks in the area. So that was kind of an ever-present consideration as well. And then human risk. So the whole of Virunga National Park and that eastern DRC region and the city of Goma, where we were basing ourselves out of, is an active conflict zone. There are multiple armed groups in the area. There is one of the largest UN peacekeeping missions active in that area. And there's a lot of banditry linked to resource exploitation in the forests. There's a lot of struggling for power. There's a lot of firearms in the area, and we knew we were going to be working around firearms, hoping obviously that we wouldn't encounter any bandits or rebel groups or anything. But we had armed guards with us the whole time, and that brings, a completely different level of working. We all had to undertake, it's called HEFAT training, so hostile environment first aid training, which is a long residential course geared specifically for film and television production, just kind of training us up in security and risk management in hostile environments. So kidnapping risks, roadblocks, all that kind of stuff. It was a very intensive course, but I felt as well prepared as one can be for that sort of a job. I think I'd already got a few years under my belt before this expedition, quite a few years. And I had worked in some conflict zones before. I'd worked in Pakistan, which is a whole other story that went horribly wrong. But I made a huge amount of mistakes and learned the hard way how to operate in those environments. And that kind of, so yeah, I guess I was approaching this from a much more informed perspective. The risks were still there, and perhaps they were even more present than the risks in places like Pakistan and Madagascar that I'd worked. But I felt better prepared for them. And again, like I mentioned before, we were a proven team. Most of us on the team had worked together quite a lot. And so I think that can go a long way towards risk mitigation when you know each other's capabilities, each other's background, and you just have that kind of gel that sort of forming stage of high performing teams has already been done for you in a sense, you know. And that, yeah, that definitely reassured me a little bit going into that kind of environment.
And like you said, you call forward a lot of experiences from the past, because it's not one of these expeditions you would go not having any background in risk mitigation to the Democratic Republic of Congo. But could you speak to, because it wasn't just only clear and present risk from human and or environmental dangers, but there was also a big logistical burden involved in this expedition. Could you sort of speak to the logistics?
Yeah, I mean, so this expedition had a high risk of failure from the outset. Spoiler alert, we succeeded in what we went to do, and I think probably more, so that's great. But we knew that there was a medium to good chance that we'd spend a lot of BBC money and not come back with what we wanted, or that something bad would happen. Obviously, we did everything we could to guard against that, but there was, yeah, that kind of operational risk, I guess, of risk to our goals. So yeah, it was a massive logistical operation. We had, I think, around a 20 strong team internationally. So a number of producers, directors from the UK, myself and Will on camera, sound recordist, a few assistant producers and stuff, and then we were working with a team of Belgian scientists who were already kind of their research project was well embedded in the country. And we, I guess, in a sense, this expedition tagged along off the back of their work. We were hoping to facilitate what they wanted to do and make a film out of it at the same time. And then we were working with well over 50 local people as well, led by our fixer. This is really bad, but his name escapes me at the moment. But he was a great guy, and he was, you know, the linchpin of success for that expedition. He made everything run as it should run on the ground. And we had involvement with the UN peacekeeping mission over there. They helped facilitate some of the stuff we wanted to do, some of the movement and security assessment and things. So yeah, I would say all in, team here, team there, well over 100 people involved. We had an advanced safety team that went out before the film crew for I think a week or two to start rigging the volcano and moving all of our equipment into position. But even despite them going out beforehand, when it came to actually climbing up the volcano and setting up our camp at the rim, we needed a huge amount of porters to help get the equipment up there. I remember one really funny moment. We're all sort of huffing and puffing, struggling our way up in the altitude with our backpacks, trying to film on the way. Obviously, everything that we're doing, but we're also filming. And there's this lady, really elegant, tall, beautiful lady, wearing flip-flops, balancing a Pelly case on her head, walking up the side of this mountain. There's me, like, overweight at the time, big poles, like huffing and puffing up there. And she's got, she didn't know it at the time, but she had about £25,000 worth of lenses balanced in this case on her head, just making it look like no effort at all. All the logistics were made entirely possible by good working with local people. But with that, it is impossible to move quickly. It was a very slow-moving expedition. Everything from road movements to get to where we needed to be to stage the expedition, to the actual movements down into the crater and along the rim edge itself, everything was very slow, which then exposes you to additional risks. You know, your exposure time increases, so the risk increases. So, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to sum it all up, really. There was just, it was an absolute, I think, as far as all of the expeditions I've done, so many now, this is probably the most logistically challenging one that I've been involved in.
So just looking at those risks, Ryan, as it unfolds, and indeed you're in the side of this volcano, did the risk profile change? Were there any sort of dynamic moving elements that you thought, actually, this is not safe, or this is absolutely fine? How, because like you said, it's not just the clear and present danger of lava, it's the noxious gases, it's the sulfur, it's the terrain underfoot, it is dynamic. How did any of the risks sort of change as you went?
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there that risk on exposition does change. It changes all the time. It's continuously changing. And you know, we all know about dynamic risk assessments and how important they are. But in this kind of environment, it is a constant changing risk assessment of what's going on. So I think although the volcano presented a huge amount of environmental risks to us, it actually also worked in our favor in shielding us from some of the human risk, just due to the remoteness. So the primary human risks came from transport to the volcano and staging out of the area in Goma that we were working, crossing. You know, we couldn't fly direct into Goma because the runway had been destroyed by a previous eruption. So we had to fly into Rwanda and then cross the border by road, which took a good day of wrangling and was not a safe environment for a large team of Westerners to be in. But then once we got up to the volcano, that human risk kind of fell away. Obviously there's always the chance of encountering rebel groups, bandits and such up there, but we had armed rangers with us to protect us. And it's, I mean, as far as tourist regions go in the DRC, it is a tourist destination more for kind of in-country tourists, but they were sort of to an extent set up for that. And it's a relatively well-protected area up on the rim of the volcano. You've got good views down all sides. There's a couple of little huts up on the top there. So once we got to the rim, we felt quite safe from a human perspective. But then the risk changed to obviously the environmental risk. That becomes much more important and the assessment of that. And I think one of the things that really caught us out was the weather. Everyone thinks volcano, lava, hot, but no, it was actually really cold up there a lot of the time. Even with the heat radiating off the lake, which you could feel, you know, while we were up there. We had rain, we had fog, we had low-lying cloud, we had sunshine. So one day you were going from risk of heat exhaustion to the next day you were going at a risk of hypothermia. And then that weather brings its own additional challenges with the stability of the rock that we're working on. I know that the advanced team that were there rigging down into the crater, they had hailstorms and snow the week before we got there, which you know, and they were caught out on the rock face when that hit, which was a massive challenge for them. And then wind moves very, very unusually around a volcano because obviously you've got the effects of it. You've got the normal weather effects and the atmospheric effects. You've got the effect of weather traveling up the slope of the volcano, and then that hits this convection updraft coming from inside the crater. So the area we're stationed right up on the rim at the top is this mixing point of kind of three different macro and microclimatic systems, which just made it completely unpredictable. One minute you'd be in the clear and fine, and the next minute the wind would shift or the convection from the volcano would overpower the local currents, and suddenly you'd find yourself in a plume of sulfur gas, with no warning at all. So I think the weather was, yeah, that was definitely one of the big changes that hit us when we got up there. And we knew it would be like that, but I don't think we knew it would be like that, if you get what I mean. Like it caught me off guard, just how different it was to what I expected.
Absolutely, absolutely. But Ryan, could you now sort of speak to, and this is more for really my benefit as well as the listeners, but just how, indeed, how remote the park is, to give an idea of kind of, it maybe indeed why it's not well covered in previous documentaries or indeed explored. Could you sort of speak to the remoteness?
Yeah, so Nyiragongo lies inside Virunga National Park, which so you've got it lies along the eastern border region of the DRC. It stretches, I think, around 8,000 square kilometers, covers the park, and it kind of melts into parks on the Rwandan and Ugandan side of the borders, the impenetrable forest and the Rwenzori Mountains. But it basically spans from the Rift Valley to the Rwenzori Mountains, and it covers altitudes of, I think, well, I guess almost sea level up to, I think the highest point is just over 5,000 meters. Infrastructure in that area is almost non-existent. What little infrastructure there is generally logging roads, built by a lot of the mining companies, which are not really a place you want to spend a lot of time because they're obviously a target point for a lot of the conflict. it's I think so you've got that natural isolation. It's spans from African savanna to rainforest to montane forest to open mountainside. So you've got all these different biomes in the area. You've got very few passable roads to move around on, poorly connected power and communications infrastructure, which has really lent the region to a lot of the conflict that goes on there. It's kind of a perfect storm of inaccessibility and a desire to exploit the area. So that's led to it being placed on the World Heritage Danger List as an area due to kind of ongoing armed conflict. A lot of it surrounding precious metals and coltan, which we use in all of our smartphone technology these days. It's just incredibly isolated, despite the fact that the park itself is only, 20 kilometers or so from Goma, this huge population center, right on Lake Kivu. It's crazy. And yeah, like I mentioned, we couldn't fly direct to Goma. We had to because the runway is impassable for anything but small planes, or I'm not sure of the current state, but it was at the time due to a previous lava flow. So again, it's the environment contributing to the inaccessibility in ways that go beyond just the borders of the park. So we had to fly into Rwanda and cross the border, which was a real challenge, and then base ourselves out of a hotel on the shore of the lake and then travel up to the national park. But as soon as you leave the city, which takes a long time because the city itself is so densely populated and difficult to get around, the roads themselves have been damaged by so many eruptions. It's crazy to be in a place that is so close to intense civilization and yet at the same time so isolated and far removed from all of it.
So just looking at the challenges of indeed just filming on the side of an active volcano, and I guess in a way sort of rolling two questions into one around sort of windows of opportunity to film, and like you said, managing the risks of noxious gases and everything else that's going on. Could you maybe just give me and listeners an idea of what it was like to film on the side of an active volcano and navigate these sort of windows of time or opportunity?
Yeah, I think one of the challenging things about expeditions, whether that's, an adventure trek, you're going as a medic, whether you're there as a film crew, whatever, is that expeditions have a habit of growing outside of time boundaries. The clock almost has no relevance, especially film crews. We're really bad for it. We're there for a reason. We're passionate about that reason. We're going to do what needs to be done. We don't really care what time of day it is as long as the light's there. And on many expeditions, I've pulled, 2, 3 day long shift, like 24 hour shift. You just film, 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 all the time because it's a huge undertaking to get there and you want to maximize that. But it's one of the brilliant things about working in equatorial regions is that you doesn't matter when you go, 12 hours of daylight. That's pretty much what you've got. So in a sense, that challenge wasn't there on this expedition. And having artificial lighting up there was just a no-go. We had very limited opportunity for that. So we had a very strict window of kind of 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. that we could film in. I think one of the time windows were primarily limited by the weather. As I say, there were just not so much the light available caused by the weather, but just the conditions that we could film in safely, and then also the movement of the gases. And there were a number of times where we had to abandon what we were filming and wait whilst the wind shifted so that we could safely work in that area again. I think one of the As I mentioned, one of the really big things that hit me about working up there was the cold. I really was expecting it to be hot. And it was really weird because the huts we were staying in were just down from the rim on the rainforest side of the volcano, for our sort of advanced camp at the top. And when you were down there, you just felt like you were kind of on the side of a mountain above a rainforest, and you were completely unaware that you've got this boiling lake of lava just below you on the other side. But as soon as you got up to the rim, there's this roaring noise, and you could hear it, you could see it sometimes when we first got up there, the cloud was so low, we're like, where's the volcano? I know I'm stood on the edge of it. I know there's like a 3 football pitch lava lake down there, but I can't see it. But you could still feel the heat on your face coming off it. But it was freezing cold. You know, I was layered up like anything, operating in gloves and a hat on the side of this massive volcano, which was just this really surreal juxtaposition that was not expected. And then I think as well, just we were all in this constant state of alert because of the risks. They were so high, myriad risks. You were aware that, yeah, you were at risk when you were hanging on a rope going down into the volcano. You were at risk walking around. You were at risk from the gases. But I was just as at risk if I had to get out of the hut at 2 o'clock in the morning and walk 20 meters and go for a wee. You know, it's there all the time. So you're in this constant high alert state of constant risk assessment, never really being able to let your guard down, which really took its toll. It was exhausting working up there, both physically and mentally. But then also it was just it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And I'm not like, you know, I'm all for purposeful expeditions, and this had a lot of purpose. I think we'll hopefully get a chance to dig into that later. But it was also a lot of fun. It was a great team of some very close friends having this incredible privileged experience in this just unreal arena, this place that doesn't feel like it should exist. And that was a real take home. It was a real privilege to be up there with my mates, making a film, telling stories, sharing the odd glass of whiskey, just having a good time despite all of the pressures and challenges that were there for us.
Well, let's just dig into why you were sort of primarily and fundamentally there, which was to kind of try and predict another eruption, or indeed try and get this sort of diagnostics in place to predict another eruption. How difficult was it to indeed capture for the audience the sort of the level of complexity about the sampling equipment, the thermal cameras, the sound waves? Did it was it quite difficult to capture that and indeed show listeners and or viewers sort of the metrics that you were gathering?
Yeah, it was super challenging. As I say, we were kind of tagging along to, and as a result, part funding in regards to the logistics for this Belgian science expedition. These four scientists, I think it was, from Belgium that were with us. So they obviously had their goals. They wanted to get the work done and get down and do it well. But then there's this big film crew here going, well, yeah, but we want to film everything that you're doing, which means you're going to need to do that bit again, and you're going to need to slow down on that bit. So there was an element of conflict there, that we just there were separate goals, and we had to find a way to mesh them together and achieve what we wanted to do. But in terms of the measurements, and the kind of the tele science, as I call it, we sort of it was a divide and conquer operation. So because we had Will, the DOP, and myself on camera, we were able to kind of split into two filming teams effectively. And you know, I would go off around the rim one day filming some of the scientists digging a seismometer down into a concrete pit on the top of the rim. Will might be off over here or down in the crater, the scientists were laying a series of microphones on the second tier, I think it was, dug into the ground to kind of get an, you know, I'm not the one to explain this science, but it gave them a sense of the movement of the lava deep within the volcano from a audiological perspective, as well as the vibrations from the seismometer. So that was really cool to see that functioning. But it was very much a scattergun effect of, okay, well, we've got this brief window here. It looks like the winds are going to be settled for an hour. We can work in that zone from a gas safety perspective. So let's smash and grab and get it done. So some bits we really did get to craft visually the way we wanted, and other bits were just what we call in TV run and gun, where you are just filming on the fly, getting whatever you can, however you can, and hoping that you have enough coverage to then tell the story of it afterwards. So yeah, the kind of the main things they were doing were the seismometer installations, the microphone. We were doing gas sampling, which, you know, that was its own challenge because we then had to put ourselves in harm's way on the edge of a plume coming over the rim so that we could get the equipment where we needed it to be to sense the chemical makeup of the gases. There was a geologist doing rock sampling to look at the silica content, which has a big influence on the lava flow speeds and the danger that that presents to Goma. And then all of this, once we came down off the volcano, then there was kind of a second element to the expedition looking at the humanitarian issues in the region, how the volcano ties into that, where we linked in with the Goma Volcano Observatory to tie that all together and integrate it into their early warning system. And then also we just looked at some of the really cool kind of medical aspects. We were looking at fluoride content in the water and how that's affecting a lot of the children's health. We're looking at the risk of cholera from poor sanitation and how difficult it is to dig latrines over there because of a lot of the houses are built on old lava flows. So there was this real, it was just this real mesh of all these different elements pulled together. And again, it comes back to teamwork, having really good on the ground logistics, really good leadership through Simon, and our production team to kind of prioritize what things we wanted to achieve each day. But then a lot of just kind of making it up on the fly as we went along.
So Ryan, could you speak to any sort of really risky moments and or kind of I guess just hairy moments whilst you're filming that you had to navigate?
Yeah, I mean, so the gas was always a risk, right? But there's not much you can do about gas other than be aware of it. So we all, whenever we were anywhere near gas, we all had to carry gas masks with us that were deployable if needed. But you know, that was a get, that was not, we couldn't continue working there. It was like our last resort get out of jail free card. If the wind shifted, put the mask on and run, or you know, walk very carefully over unstable rocks. And they have these really crazy things called mazukus over there, which is a Swahili word for evil wind, where the gas can sit down, the carbon dioxide sits down in a low pocket because it's more dense than the air, but it's completely undetectable to human senses. And if you stumble into one of those, you can drop flat in seconds. So there was no lone working. We were always buddied up. And we actually did a little bit in the documentary, if you're interested, where we used a goat that came to no long-term harm. We actually resuscitated the goat afterwards very effectively. But to see the effect of these heat sinks, that was pretty cool. But in terms of actual hairy moments that we experienced, that all came really from human risk. So on the first functioning day of the expedition, so we were there for a few days, you know, shaking hands, meeting the right people, just doing the things you have to do in that sort of an area to make this kind of an expedition work. But the first operational day of the expedition, when we were traveling up to the volcano, you know, we'd had it drilled into us through these HEFAC courses and briefings by Aldo. One of the most significant risks on expedition is movement. And lo and behold, we're going through the market area on the first day, barely 20 minutes into our journey, when we're involved in an RTC. We're traveling in a convoy of, I think, three Land Rovers, and a motorbike hit one of the Land Rovers from the back. So obviously we had to stop, see what was going on. But then there's a, it was a very ethically challenging situation because do you get out of the car and see what's going on when there's a crowd building, potentially a hostile crowd, or do you keep driving and hope they're okay, but knowing that you may have, although it wasn't our fault, we were involved in something and someone could have come to harm. So that was really difficult. And that was where we really just relied on the experience of Aldo and our close protection safety team and their communications between the different vehicles in assessing the situation from inside the vehicles. Thankfully, ultimately, the guy got up, got back on his bike, drove off. He came to no harm. We didn't have to load out of the vehicles or anything, but straight away it was like snapping into this place of, wow, this isn't just a textbook anymore. Like, this is real. We're 20 minutes in and we've already had our first close call. Another situation, we were at this roadblock. And the BBC, rightly so, has a strict anti-bribery policy. But the guards were looking for a bribe. The military guys at the roadblock, and so there was a really tense standoff between our driver and the guards trying to get through this roadblock. And it was just this awareness of like, we are surrounded by a bunch of unpredictable people with large firearms and nowhere to run if it goes wrong. So you really had to rely on your training, on the teamwork, and keeping a cool head in that situation. But it was scary. There were some scary moments there. And then a scary moment that turned out to just be a funny moment was we were heading over to I think it's called Naumalagira, another volcano in the area, by helicopter. We were traveling with the South African contingent of the UN team. And as part of the filming, we'd open the door on the helicopter. I'm harnessed in, effectively hanging out of the door so that I can film back into the helicopter. And the pilot's going really low to the forest and really fast and banking. And, by this point in my career, I've spent a lot of time working in and around helicopters, both filming and my experience in mountain rescue. But he was flying like I've never seen a pilot fly before. And it's due to the risk of banditry. If the armed groups in the area see you coming, then they can shoot at you. So it's, avoidance flying. But I'm there hanging out of this helicopter and I feel this massive bang on my leg. And I was convinced I'd been shot. It felt so hard. Just this sharp pain in the side of my leg. And so I loaded back into the helicopter and I sort of pulled my trousers. I'm looking, what's happened? And there's absolutely nothing. And for a moment there, I was like, heart rate's going 1,000 miles an hour. I'm like terrified that I've just been shot in the leg. To this day, all I can think of is that we just hit an insect very fast, that or something like that, a large insect that just the speed we were going. But that was a moment where I think my animal instinct was terrified, and then afterwards I was like, "Oh, that was kind of funny."
Like you said, on this expedition, there's multiple touch points of a risk of just crazy things happening, Ryan, and predictable and unpredictable. And there's a clear mandate for the filming. But could you maybe speak to the team dynamics? Because it did have multiple moving parts. There's multiple teams all working together under constant pressure. What were the sort of human factors and/or team dynamics like?
I mean, I could talk for hours just about the human factors on this expedition, but I guess to break down the key elements, that as I've already mentioned, one of the main I hesitate to use the word conflict because it wasn't conflict, it was conflicting goals. But one of the main kind of touch points was the crossover between what the scientists wanted to achieve and what the film crew wanted to achieve. Pardon me, because obviously the way we had to go about it for telescience influenced directly their real science, but we didn't want to negatively impact on what they were trying to do. So it was difficult to find a balance between the two. And I put a lot of the success in that down to, like I say, really good leadership. We had very experienced producer running the show. And we just had really good communication through the team throughout, which overcame a lot of those challenges. And it was also one of those things, we hadn't met the scientists before, but the more we worked with them, the more they understood what we wanted, we understood what they wanted, and we were able to find compromises that worked. And the other real kind of touch point in terms of team dynamics was between the safety team and the film crew. We're all good friends. Most of us had met before. We had Aldo running the safety team, and underneath him, we had a couple of rope supervisors. We had a paramedic who is ex-military and also a close protection operative. But their singular goal is to keep us safe, and our singular goal is to get ourselves in awkward situations to get the best shots possible. And on top of all of that, you've got the slow speed of movement. So any risk that's there increases the longer you're exposed to it. So again, it was just this constant juggling act of myself, Will, the directors going, well, this is what we want to achieve here. Aldo going, well, these are the risks. And then finding a way to balance and mitigate that, because often, I'd want to get into a position that, that to get an angle on the scientists that we were filming that put me at unacceptable levels of risks. And at those points, it was really important that we had that hierarchy and that structure in the team of, we've all got a goal, we've all got a job to do, but Aldo calls the shots on the safety, and I can have a conversation with him about what's acceptable and what isn't. But ultimately, it's his call, and that we had to have respect for that for the whole thing to work, and we did. And Aldo, he's incredibly experienced and led the team impeccably well. And again, I put a lot of the fact that we didn't have any serious incidents down to how phenomenal our safety team were in both looking after us and managing our expectations of what we could achieve within the constraints that were there.
So Ryan, as we start to come into land, just a couple more questions. One, I guess one of the probably key questions before we sort of look at whether this was one of the most challenging shoots you've ever done. Could you maybe initially speak to sort of maybe sort of the most profound aspect to the expedition and indeed the work? If you could just speak to sort of the most profound aspects that you found on that expedition.
Yeah, I mean, so I had the privilege, because I wasn't the director of photography, I wasn't overseeing the primary filming in the volcano, which meant that I got to be involved in a lot of the offshoot filming. And that gave me a lot of exposure to the humanitarian and the kind of macro aspects of what we were looking at. So I got to tag out early from the volcano and go and film the gorillas in the national park, the mountain gorillas, and film with some of the projects and the community within the national park, which for me was definitely the most profound aspect of it, because I'd been up the volcano and I'd done kind of the exciting stuff, and that was really cool. And that was going into the expedition, that was what I wanted to be involved in. But actually, it was then seeing the why behind all of that that impacted me the most. Meeting, so we filmed with a group of widows of rangers who had lost their lives trying to protect the gorillas. And we had the privilege of spending an afternoon with them filming in one of the memorial buildings to the rangers that were lost. And I remember Xander, the presenter, asking the ladies at one point, would they want that? Because they had children there with them as well. It was like a knitting workshop, a stitching workshop. And he asked them if they would want their kids that were babies to grow up and be rangers. And without hesitation, they all said yes straight away. And that hit me. And then going into the room to film the memorial, Xander, if you watch the documentary, you see Xander in tears on the camera. What you don't see is that after that filming, we left the room and I had to put the camera down and go back into the room myself and just stand in there and cry myself for a little bit. It was so profound and moving to see the kind of nexus of all of the issues in this area, which are massive and appear insurmountable, but to see the hope amongst the people living there, working with the national park to, set up small business enterprise, to install hydroelectric power, to get on top of the banditry. They all realize that although the volcano and the impact that has, it's like a how do I, it's like a jellyfish or a spider. Its tentacles spread out throughout the whole region, the volcano, and it impacts everything there. If it wasn't for the volcano, there wouldn't be the mineral content, there wouldn't be the banditry. If it wasn't for the forest, and the gorillas in the forest, then the tourists wouldn't be coming, so they wouldn't be trying to attack the gorillas to stop the interest in the area so that they can keep mining. Like, all of the corruption and conflict in the area comes back to the geology and the geopolitics as a result of the volcano and the environment. But to see the people just have such hope and realize that although a lot of that causes a lot of their problems, it also provides the solutions. And we filmed in one of the local markets, and one of the ladies says the only line really that ever really sticks with me from the whole film is she says, the volcano, it both gives and it takes life. And it's so true. And it was just so powerful and caught me off guard to see the life in that area. I was there for the adventure, the excitement, the volcano, the gorillas, the wildlife, but it was the people that I took away. And it still gets me to this day. Like, it breaks me when I really start to think about it.
So just finally, oh, that's powerful, actually, Ryan. And yeah, there's a lot of it's really moving to sort of hear that, really. But just finally, sort of looking back at the retrospectoscope, would you say this is or was one of the most challenging expeditions you'd sort of ever done?
I would, yeah. I mean, every expedition has its own challenges, right? I've been so fortunate and blessed throughout my career to travel, you know, I've six continents, well over 50 countries, I think, at last count, in pretty much every environment you can think of, with teams of just myself or two of us and teams of, you know, 50, 60 people. And every environment, every expedition has its own challenges and its own risks. But this one was just, it was really, it sticks out as one of the expeditions I went on that brought all those different types of risk together. It was all there on this one. The environmental risk, the human risk, the logistical challenge, the risks, the operational risks to what we wanted to achieve. It was all there. And I had to draw on every ounce of experience that I'd built and lean heavily on my more experienced teammates that were there to learn from. And everyone was bringing multiple things to the table to make it work. Everyone had multiple hats on. But it was just this. I think this expedition for me, one, it was a turning point in my career. As I spoke about, you know, the widows and the fact that I went for the adventure, but it was the people that I brought away. It was a real turning point in my career in my understanding of why it was that I was doing what I was doing and what I wanted to keep doing and what I wanted that to look like. The sort of my motivation changed. It was really pivotal in that regard. And also, it just really, I think, embedded all of the learning that I'd done over the previous 6 or 7 years of expeditions before that. It just really embedded the importance of having that shared understanding of risk and effective teamwork and collective goal setting in achieving what you want to achieve. It kind of showed that you can do incredible things, powerful things, both from a, like, you're achieving amazing goals and you can have a profound impact and communicate incredible stories. But you have to do the groundwork to make all that happen. And that all comes back to this very emergency services term, the shared understanding of risk. And when you can kind of really nail those human factors, and we didn't get everything right, but I think as far as things go, we did a pretty good job of managing human factors on this expedition, led by some incredible people, Aldo, Will, Simon, to name check a few of the people that were really, you know, couldn't have done it without them. But yeah, we did a pretty good job. I'm proud to have been involved in it. I'm privileged to be been involved in it. And I kind of came home from that thinking, yeah, I don't think we could have done much better.
That's fantastic, Ryan. That's absolutely fantastic. We'll put the link to the movie indeed in the show notes so people can read and see more. But there's just to get your first-hand experience and indeed recollection is powerful. So thank you for the last hour.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks again for having me back. It's been a real pleasure to talk about it. It was a powerful expedition for me. It changed me in a lot of ways. So I love sharing the story behind it.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.